keep you updated. But so we want to finish off this Christmas season just with the third in this short series that we've been doing about Christmas and crisis management. And we're going to be in two different passages this morning. I don't typically make you flip too much, but so the first one, if you want to turn just to be prepared to be there when we get to it, we're going to be in Revelation chapter 12 first. This morning, and then eventually we'll make our way to Ephesians chapter 6. Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 to 5 is where we're going to begin. But the significance of Christmas, as we've seen over the last 2 weeks, is that very specifically that God became, the Son became a man, Jesus, in order to save men from the crisis of sin. In the Bible, sometimes they call that darkness. He came in to shine a light into darkness, to intervene in the crisis that humanity was experiencing because of sin. And that sin, that crisis, was caused by Lucifer, who was that angel that wanted to be a god, and when he failed, he became the adversary. He took on the role of adversary. We call him Satan. He took on the role of the false accuser. And so we call him the devil. And he took on the job of spreading the darkness of sin into the world, beginning with Adam and Eve. And in order to end then the crisis that sin causes for all of us, the death that is a result of sin that wasn't part of the plan, the separation from God that wasn't intended when God made man, in order to end that crisis under the orchestration of God the Father, God the Son was miraculously conceived by God the Spirit in Mary and born as Jesus in order to save any who would believe in Him. In that truth that Jesus was actually God, born to live, die, and then rise from the dead in order to save men from the crisis of sin. Jesus became the rescuer for any who would believe. And this is what we celebrated 2 days ago, that incredible moment in history that God came to men in order to rescue them from the crisis of sin through that miraculous birth of Jesus. And the rescue of men, I want you to hear this, the rescue of men is not something, in the context of what we've been talking about, that is not something that Satan was going to allow without a fight. Don't imagine for a moment that Satan, because he wanted to be God and he hated that others worship God and he targeted Adam and Eve in order to disrupt and steal humanity from that relationship with God. Don't think for a second that Jesus being born, that God becoming a man, isn't something that Satan wasn't going to oppose as the adversary with all of his strength. He was not going to allow that without a fight. We have to remember the crisis, the battle that has been waged and is being waged for the souls of men and women on earth. So this was no ordinary birth that we celebrated 2 days ago. It was the beginning of a rescue in the middle of a supernatural conflict. It was the beginning of the rescue in this conflict. And to remind us of that, John, he's the one that writes the book of Revelation. John gives us a glimpse beyond the simplicity of Jesus' birth in Bethlehem and his book Revelation. And so invite you to read with me Revelation chapter 12. We're going to look at verses 1 to 5. And let me give you this disclaimer too. So John writes in a visionary way, which is to say that he writes something that he saw in like a dream. And if you've ever tried to describe to people a dream that you have had, which are usually pretty unusual, it's difficult to communicate to them, right? If you've ever had a dream and you try to explain to somebody, well, we were at my house, but it wasn't really my house. It looked like my house, and I knew it was my house, but it was actually not my house, right? And you're trying to imagine, okay, so it was, but it wasn't your house. And you're like, yeah, and so there was like, the paint was this way, but like I could see through the wall, like all of that stuff. If you ever tried to describe that, right? I know I knew the person in my dream, but they didn't look like the person I knew they were. They were actually this person, but I knew it was, right? Explaining dreams to people is impossible. Some of you maybe keep dream journals, and you look at that, and you're like, man, I'm crazy. I like this stuff is weird, right? Dreams are weird to explain. John's trying to explain something, first of all, in a very ancient language, in a very ancient culture, that he's trying to communicate to us now thousands of years apart from that, what he saw. So just keep that in mind. It's going to sound a little odd. That's what I'm saying. So Revelation chapter 12, this is behind the simplicity of Jesus' birth. Verse 1 says this, "A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. And she was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth." Now pause. So the woman here, you may assume, your gut might be telling you, is Mary. It's not. Your gut probably tells you, oh, woman, pregnant, I get this. I know where we're going with this one. This is Mary. She was pregnant. I understand. It's not Mary. The 12 stars on her head identify her as Israel, the nation of Israel, as a person. Again, John's like, all right, so there was this nation of Israel. It was actually a woman, but I knew it was her because she was wearing a crown. It had 12 stars, right? So it's actually the nation of Israel, and she's pregnant. And so John is relating to us this visible representation of the truth that the chosen one, the one to rescue from sin, the Messiah, the Christ, the Savior of men, he's trying to give us this representation that he would be an Israelite. He would be born from Israel, as promised by God to Abraham. That's what John's trying to tell us. With this pregnant woman with 12 stars, going to give birth, he's trying to say Jesus was a Jew. He's trying to say Jesus was from Israel and God promised that. Israel is about to produce the rescuer. So, yes, Mary was pregnant with Jesus, and in that way, Israel was pregnant with Jesus, if that makes sense. So, she's about to give birth, and then verse 3. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on its heads. Its tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that it might devour her child the moment he was born. And so this is the adversary. This is Satan. This is how John is envisioning him. That doesn't mean that this is how Satan actually looks. Right, this is a vision. It's a representation of the enormity of Satan, the threat that Satan poses, the authority that Satan has on earth. And so this is the adversary. And when Satan fell, you saw here, he said that you have this red dragon, and its tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. And so when Satan attempted to usurp God, God cast him to the earth, and with him, Satan brought a number of angels who were also banished from God's presence because of his sin. And so they became what we call today his demons, with the same goal as Satan. They all have the same goal. And I want you to see the conflict that's happening behind this birth. They have the same goal that Satan had, to break the relationship that God has with humanity, to prevent God from having a restored relationship with the ones that he made. And you'll notice what Satan is described as doing here in this verse by John. He swept the stars, but what is he waiting to do? He's waiting to devour the child when it's born. He's waiting to end the threat to what he's doing on earth. And he's wanting to prevent him from rescuing a single person from the darkness of sin and death. That is his desire, and that's what you're seeing here that John is describing. And so God became a man, right? That birth happened. Jesus was born. Look at Revelation chapter 12, verse 5, just the very beginning, right? So she gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And so Jesus was born. We just talked about that last week. We celebrated it two days ago. Jesus was born. But what is happening behind the scenes of that birth? We see an innocent birth, right? We see a normal night, a significant birth, though, because it's Jesus, the Son of God. And so it's a significant birth. But behind the scenes, Satan is thinking, how do I end this? Satan is waiting to devour the rescuer. He's waiting to end and stop whatever this boy is going to try to do to rescue men from sin. And that boy, though, was born and will one day, John says, be the ruler of nations. So the conflict grew. In Satan's mind, it's on. this is the beginning. It's the beginning of the rescue for Jesus. And for Satan, this is the beginning of the battle. The real battle has begun for the souls of men. When the light came to darkness, the Word became flesh. God became a man. Jesus, the one who will save his people from their sin, was born. And the struggle intensified as the rescue began. And Satan sought to prevent the rescue by devouring the chosen one. And Satan and his demons are not going to sit by, you would imagine, while God worked as God the Son to save mankind. That's not something Satan wants. And so Satan's influence within his kingdom of darkness within this world is strong. And when Jesus was between the ages of 2 and 3, last week I said he was 3 years old, and that's because, and I was asked, wasn't he more like 2? And I was asked, and I said, well, but I'm a guy. And I round, right? Guys kind of round up. Like, moms tend to be like, oh, no, they're 25 months, right? Maybe not that far, but they're 25 months. I don't want to call him 2 yet. I don't want to call him 3 yet. He's not 3. In fact, I've had this conversation with Kate, because with Amelia, I've already started calling. I'm like, she's basically 3 years old. And she's like, no, she's not. Don't make her older than she is yet, right? But we're guys. Guys round. We round up and we round down. He's there too. So I said Jesus was 3 last week. He was between 2 and 3. I'm just rounding. You'll forgive me, I hope. When Jesus was between 2 and 3, wise men from Iraq came to worship him. And they were led there by the star. You probably talked about it a few days ago. They were led there by a star. And in Jerusalem, they asked for directions. So these wise men, they want to see Jesus. They follow the star. They stop in Jerusalem. They ask for directions to see the King of the Jews. That's what they called him. They said, we know the King of the Jews was born. And so they stop in Jerusalem, the center of Judaism, the home of the Jews. And they say, hey, we're looking for the King of the Jews. But this was news to the current King of the Jews. Right? The current King of the Jews, Herod the Great, was a little bit concerned by these guys because he's thinking, oh, I didn't have a son, and I'm the King of the Jews. So if you're looking for someone born the King of the Jews and they're not in my family, this is a problem for me, right? And so a man completely enveloped and committed to the law of sin and death, a man consumed by Satan's kingdom of darkness, and think and imagine Satan is crouching, hoping to devour the rescuer, behind the scenes orchestrating. So this man, consumed by Satan's kingdom of darkness, enacted a plan that had the adversary written all over it. In Matthew chapter 2, verse 8, we see this happening. So Herod sent the wise men to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. But we know that's not what Herod wanted to do. This boy was a threat if he was really the King of the Jews. And so when Herod realized, because the wise men did not, they call them the Magi here, when they did not return, they did not tell him, when Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. And he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned of the birth from the Magi. And so this has the adversary written all over it. Convince this man that this boy is a threat, and motivate him to find him and murder him and kill him. And just in case you miss, kill every boy that was born in that town in the last 2 years just to make sure that you get him. He intended to kill Jesus, but when his plan to manipulate the wise men failed, he killed every boy in Bethlehem. All casualties in Satan's quest to devour the rescuer. Jesus wasn't killed, though, when Herod did this, because the battle was ongoing and God had intervened. Look at Matthew chapter 2, verse 13 and 15. When they had gone, when the Magi had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph. So the wise men left after visiting them. An angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, and he said, get up, take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. So Joseph got up and took the child and his mother during the night, and they left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so it was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. But you see this, you see the conflict? Satan is motivating Herod out of selfishness, out of the sin nature inside him, to try to end the life of the rescuer. Herod doesn't even know he's the rescuer. He just thinks he's a threat to his throne, but Satan knows that he's motivating Herod, and so God intervenes and sends his representative and says, Joseph, you've got to leave the battle's coming. He wants to devour your son because of the threat that he poses to him in this world. The struggle to save mankind was real. It was an ongoing conflict. And we don't know much about Jesus' childhood in Egypt, and then when they moved eventually to Nazareth. But we do know that Satan wasn't done trying to devour the rescuer. When Jesus was 30, Satan came to him directly with a more clever attempt to end his mission to rescue. And we have that recorded, a part of it in Mark chapter 1, verses 12 to 13. Mark says that in his biography, he says that once God the Spirit sent Jesus out into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness 40 days being tested by Satan. He was with wild animals and angels attended to him. And so you can see, even in that verse, you see the conflict. Satan is testing and angels are helping. There is a battle. There is a conflict. And in this case, the struggle to save mankind was through this test that Satan gives Jesus for 40 days. Now, in the account that we have in Luke and in Matthew, we only see three of them. We only see three of the tests. But Satan was testing Jesus for over a month. He was testing him in order to see if he could get to the one who was supposed to live without sin to sin. Satan was doing to Jesus the same thing that he did to Adam and Eve. You're supposed to live without sin. Let me see if I can get you to sin then. Because if he can get the one who's supposed to live without sin to sin, the rescue is over. And so for that month, there is a battle, a conflict, an ongoing struggle between the rescuer and the one who wants to stop the rescue. A battle for the souls of mankind. But Jesus passes that test. And that test was a lot harder than Adam and Eve's test. They had one test. Jesus had 40 days of this test. But he passes the test and resists Satan. But look what Luke writes when he finishes. When Luke describes this in his biography of Jesus, when the devil had finished all this tempting, he left Jesus until the opportune time because he wasn't done. He's not going to just let him rescue men. He's going to keep pushing against them. He wasn't done with this attempt to end the rescue. And so, and Jesus reveals shortly after that, the religious zeal that the Pharisees demonstrate, the Jewish leaders of their day, the zeal that they demonstrate in their opposition to him, Jesus actually points out, hey, your opposition to me, your zeal in trying to end what I'm teaching and trying to end me, it's not, in fact, what you believe to be service to God. You think you're serving God and trying to get me to stop teaching, but it's not in service to God. Like you think, it's actually unwitting service to Satan. He says it in John chapter 8, verses 43 and 44. Jesus says to them, these Pharisees, who are trying to discredit him, trying to end his ministry, why is my language not clear to you? Because you're unable to hear what I say. Because you belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth. For there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he's a liar and the father of lies. Jesus tells them, look, you think you're serving God, but really you're part of a greater conflict and you're on the wrong side. You're on the side of Satan, the adversary who's trying to lie and end my ministry and end the rescue. And it appears that Jesus sees what others don't, that others don't understand is happening, that they were engaged in a proxy battle. That the Pharisees were just proxies. They were filling in Jesus on behalf of God and the Pharisees on behalf of Satan, trying to get Jesus murdered and end the rescue. They were trying to convict him of blasphemy so they could kill him on behalf of Satan. And this appears to be Satan's strategy, who seemed to be convinced that if Jesus were killed, then that would be the end of the rescue. It seems to be what he's shooting at now. If we can just get Jesus killed, then the rescue will be over. And that would deny God the restored relationship with the creation that Satan had corrupted, and that was his goal. And so Satan then got one of Jesus' own followers in on the scheme. In John chapter 13, John tells us when this happened, verse 2. At the evening meal, and this was the meal actually just before Jesus was killed, the evening meal, the Passover meal, was in progress, and the devil had already prompted Judas, one of Jesus' 12 followers, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Satan seems pretty convinced if I can just kill Jesus, the rescue will be over. The Pharisees couldn't do it. Herod couldn't do it. I'll get Judas to betray him, and we'll make it happen that way. And within 24 hours of Judas's betrayal, Jesus was murdered on a cross. And I would imagine at that moment that Satan celebrated pretty hard along with his demons because they, in his mind, had won the battle, believing that they had won, that the rescue and the salvation of mankind had been stopped because Jesus was dead, not realizing the truth that John had told us, that darkness can't overcome the light. It can't overcome the Son of God. The reason that Jesus came was to destroy the devil's work, and he didn't know he was playing right into his plans. Because Jesus didn't remain in the grave, and you can imagine that smug smile on Satan's face. When Jesus rose from the dead and showed up after his victory tour, we talked about this when we studied 1 Peter, after his victory tour, and he showed up alive, very real and very alive, and not actually dead. And Satan realizes in that moment, I don't think we can kill him. I don't think he can die because he was sinless. And in that moment, Satan realizes that maybe he's fighting a losing battle. And in his description of the conflict then, in Revelation, John tells us that the dragon, though he may have momentarily thought he had won, but he did not actually devour the child. Look at Revelation chapter 12, verse 5. We read the very beginning of it, right? They gave birth to a son, a male child. He was going to rule all the nations with an iron scepter, but the dragon, Satan, is there hoping to devour it. And her child, though, before he could devour, was snatched up to God and to his throne. And so instead of thinking that, knowing that he had won, Jesus, having been risen from the dead, went to be with his Father God, very alive, not dead. He rose from the dead. He defeated the power of sin and then ascended to heaven to God's side until the time comes to end the war that Satan wages against the rescue, wages against God. And finally, Jesus will return to end the crisis of sin that we all face and we all experience every single day. He will return to gather those who chose to place their faith in him and no one else. In his life, that he was God. In his death, that wouldn't last. In his resurrection, that would be permanent and life-giving for everybody that believes. Those are the ones he will return for to rescue from the crisis of sin, to rescue from the eternity of death. But until he returns, Satan and his demons continue to fight to prevent the rescue of as many men as they can. They realize they can't prevent the rescue now of mankind, but they may be able to prevent the rescue of as many as possible. And Paul tells us, which we'll see here in a moment, and if you want to prepare and turn to Ephesians, we're going to be in Ephesians chapter 6 here to finish. But Paul tells us that what we'll see in a moment, that Satan has schemes. Satan has schemes in order to prevent the rescue from as many men as possible. Peter tells us when he writes in his letter, for that reason, because Satan has schemes, that we should be alert, we should be clear-headed or sober-minded, as he says. We should be aware, we should be focused about the fact that there are schemes that Satan is trying actively still. He tried very hard to prevent the rescuer from rescuing, and now he's trying very hard to prevent men from being rescued themselves. And so what are these schemes? What are we to be alert of? What are we to be aware of? What are we to look for and focus on and understand? This is what Satan is trying to do. The first one, and I know you're going to look at these next three points if you're following in the worship guide, and you're going to be like, those aren't parallel. Grammatically, they're not parallel. I get it. Calm down. I understand. You just have to bear with me. You can fix it on your own. But the first scheme is that everybody born is born spiritually dead. Every single person in the world who was born is born spiritually dead. That means spiritually separated from God. It means that relationship with God is inherently and naturally broken. Born spiritually dead in the kingdom of darkness. They're living under, by nature, the law of sin. It means they have to sin. They choose sin. And that's a bad thing because sin causes death. And when we die, that sin that we can't avoid causes us to be separated from God for eternity. We cannot live for eternity with God if we have sin. The problem is we are all born with sin. Everyone is born spiritually dead. It's the first scheme. Introduce sin into the world and everyone will be separated from God. Romans chapter 5, Verse 12 says, Paul writes, that just as sin entered the world through one man, that was Adam, death came through sin then. And in this way, because everybody sins, death comes to all people. Death is a result of sin. Separation from God is a result of sin. And he also says in chapter 7, verse 5, that when we were in the realm of the flesh, that means how we are when we're born, the way we are when we're born. When we were in the realm of the flesh, the sinful passions aroused by the law of sin and death were at work in us so that we bore fruit for death. We sin. Everyone is born spiritually dead, and that is a problem. Because when we physically die, if we are spiritually dead, we will remain separated from God forever. And this is the ultimate strategy for Satan. Introduce sin into humanity and the world, separate men from God then, and then eventually it will kill them and make their separation permanent forever. No hope of eternity. And it has worked very well for Satan. It worked great for Satan. The only problem was the rescuer came. The rescuer came. And Satan, though he tried, he couldn't prevent Jesus from living a perfect life and then willingly sacrificing himself to take payment for that sin that people were born spiritually dead with. He couldn't stop him from taking that and saying, I'm going to make the payment for all these people. I'm going to die even though I don't have to. I should live forever, but I'm going to die in order to make the payment for them so they don't have to be separated from God. They don't have to suffer that consequence. Satan couldn't stop him from doing that. And then Jesus, so he did, but then he left. He lived after, and he left one day to rescue those who placed their faith in that salvation. And say, I believe that Jesus gave his life for me, so I wouldn't have to be separated from God forever. I believe that. And Jesus said, if you believe that, I will come back for you. Satan couldn't plan for that. And that was the flaw in his plan. And that message, the gospel, that Jesus came to rescue us from the power, the penalty, the power, and the presence from sin. The gospel, that message, is the biggest threat to Satan's plan. He's going to make people spiritually dead from birth. And the biggest threat to his plan is the gospel. Romans chapter 1, verse 16, Paul said, I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes. It breaks their spiritual death. It is the one thing, the powerful thing that fights Satan's scheme. First to the Jews, then to the Gentile, meaning everyone. The gospel is the biggest threat to Satan's plan because if you hear it and you believe it, you are no longer spiritually dead. It makes you new and it rescues you from the law of sin. And so to prevent people from hearing the gospel then, because that is the biggest threat to your spiritual death, to prevent people from hearing the gospel and it changing their eternal destiny, Satan has two more strategies. The first strategy is make sure that people are born spiritually dead. The second one is that he spiritually blinds those who were born spiritually dead. He blinds them. He makes it very difficult for that message, the gospel, the biggest threat, he makes it very difficult for them to hear it or understand it or grasp onto it. He wants to prevent the gospel from reaching hearts. Paul says this in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4. He says, the God of this age, that's just his way of referring to Satan, the God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so they cannot see the light of the gospel that displays the glory of Christ, the salvation of Christ, that he was God, the image of God, come to rescue. The God of this world, Satan, blinds them so they cannot see it. How does he do that? Satan's kingdom is the kingdom of darkness. Every citizen of the kingdom of darkness lives in Satan's environment. That environment, the world that we live in, is cultivated to keep people blind in sin. Jesus told a story that was meant to teach us a spiritual lesson about different responses that people have to the gospel. When they hear that Jesus died and lived, died, and rose from the dead to pay for their sins, Jesus wanted to tell us, this is how people respond. And he describes it like a story about a man who sows seed. And look at how he describes one of those people in Mark chapter 4, verse 15. He says, some people are like the seed when they hear that gospel sown along the path where the word is sown. As soon as they hear it, Satan comes and takes away the word that was sown to them. He doesn't want them to grasp it. He doesn't want them to get it. He wants to distract them. He cannot. The gospel is the biggest threat to his plan and his strategy, and he cannot have people hearing it. And he does it a number of ways. He blinds people. He uses his kingdom of darkness. He uses its culture. He uses the message of the world. He uses its values in the world. He uses the priorities the world tells us to prioritize. He uses its lies to keep the gospel away, to dilute the gospel, to make it seem a little bit less powerful, to change a little bit, make people think that you can believe whatever you want to believe as long as you believe something. And he dilutes it and he keeps them blind to keep their hearts from that message. The message of the gospel is the threat to Satan's fight against the rescue and against God. And so he does what he can to spiritually blind the people of the world. And then, since Jesus is no longer here to spread the gospel, his second strategy, or third, since Jesus is no longer here to spread the good news, Peter tells us that he does this. In chapter 5, verse 8 of 1 Peter, he tells believers to be alert and sober-minded because your enemy, the devil, he prowls around looking like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. And really what he means is that Satan, because Jesus is no longer there, Satan turns his attention to believers and he looks to trap us. He looks to trap believers. And so his first strategy is to blind unbelievers, and his second strategy is to trap believers. Keep them from spreading the message. Keep them from hearing the message. Keep them from spreading the message, because the gospel is the biggest threat to Satan's scheme, to keep people blind, to keep people lost, to keep people spiritually dead. And as a lion waiting to devour its prey, and any attempt to spread the gospel of rescue, Satan desires to tempt believers with sin that will discredit us and take us out of the fight. He schemes to distract believers with battles not worth fighting, and hills not worth dying on, so that you don't focus on the gospel, you focus on fighting that small skirmish over there. He desires to weaken believers by circumstances and culture around them. Like he desired with Jesus, he wants to devour believers. Not take their salvation, because he can't, but prevent them from spreading the life-giving gospel. And he's done a good job. He's done a good job here in America, because only 10% of American believers share their faith in a given year. Talk about trapped. There is one thing that is the threat to Satan's scheme, and it is the gospel, and only 10% of believers share the gospel in a year. He's taken us out of the fight. He has distracted us. He's weakened us, and he has made us a non-factor in the conflict for the rescue of mankind, a conflict that heightened at Jesus' birth and continues to this day. So what do we do? Paul has an answer for that. Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10 to 13. What do we do then? Satan wants to trap us. He has blinded the minds of unbelievers. He's trying to keep people spiritually dead. He's trying to trap believers. So what do we do? Paul says, Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10, be strong in the Lord then, and in his mighty power, verse 11, put on the full armor of God, so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Therefore, put on the full armor of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground. And after you have done everything, to stand, fight, resist. Paul reminds us again, we have to stand against these schemes, because Satan desires to devour the messengers. He goes on to say, look, as Christians, our struggles are not against flesh and blood. They may seem like they are. They may seem like they're physical issues. They may seem like the situations around us are the struggle. But all of those things, the physical issues, the relational issues, the situational things, the cultural things, they are all symptoms. We have to understand that we are part of a greater conflict in the world. The issues that we face, the culture that we deal with, all that we see is actually part of the war for the rescue of mankind. We live in a world that has been corrupted and twisted and reshaped and redesigned behind the scenes by evil in order to distract us and frustrate us and weaken us so that we do anything and everything else but share the gospel. So we fight battles that we could win all the time and never actually fight the one that matters. And so for that reason, Paul says we have to have a strategy as well. If that's Satan's strategy, then we also have to have a strategy as well. And that strategy centers around putting on the full armor of God. Because the day of evil, your day of evil, Paul says, the day of evil, he doesn't say might come, he says it will come. When it comes, because you are part of a bigger conflict, like it or not, he will come for you. He will come to devour you. He will come to make you fight a battle you never wanted to fight, to keep you out of the battle you should be fighting. And when it comes, you need to be ready. You need to have a strategy. You must stand your ground. And I know that sounds insidious, the day of evil, but Paul is saying that Satan is going to try to weaken you. He is going to try to distract you. He is going to get in the way of you sharing the gospel, and you must be ready for his attacks. And some of you may be realizing right now, the last time I shared the gospel was years ago. My day of evil came and I did not fight. And I have been out of the battle. I have been down for the count. I didn't stand my ground. And he has succeeded because I haven't shared the gospel at all. And I know it sounds huge. It sounds dramatic calling it the day of evil. And it might be huge. And it might be dramatic. He might orchestrate events so that you're in the wrong place at the wrong time to perfectly fit your biggest sin struggle. Right? That may be your day of evil. That may be the battle that he orchestrated so you're in the wrong place at the wrong time to perfectly fit your struggle. Or he might manipulate men or nature with the corruption of sin so the world is crippled by a viral pandemic and Christians have to stay home and people are less willing to meet face to face and relationships are harder and churches are closed. That may be the day of evil where he said, where one of his schemes is to keep you from spreading the gospel. Let's just make everybody sick and afraid of each other. That'll shut them down. But your day of evil doesn't have to be that dramatic. It doesn't have to be something that big and bold. It might be something as simple as preventing you from getting a good night's sleep by getting your neighbor's dog to bark all night so that you're grumpy and irritable the next day with your coworkers, with your friend, or your family. And that also is one of his, it's day of evil. Your day of evil will come because Satan is in the business of preventing the spread of the gospel, and he is tireless. So our strategy then centers around the armor of God. We have to have a strategy. So what is that armor? And we could spend time, and I want to go quick, because I know that we're getting late here, but we could spend time dissecting the actual armor pieces that Paul describes here. But I think for us today, it would distract us from the point. The point is the strategy. And so instead of the type of armor it is, we want to focus on the spiritual significance of that armor. And so look at verses 14 to 18 very quickly here. Paul says in verse 14, "Stand firm then with the belt of truth buckled around your waist, with a breastplate of righteousness in place, with your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to all this, take up the shield of faith with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one, and take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God." So Paul says, what will help you stand firm in this universal cosmic conflict for the rescue and souls of mankind is truth, is righteousness. I'm going to go back through these, so if you're trying to scramble fast, don't worry. Is truth, is righteousness, is readiness rooted in peace, is faith, is the hope of salvation and the words of God. That's what's going to help you in this conflict. Those things. And notice that Paul did not say what you really need to fight this battle and be more effective is more money or more Christian culture or more time or better government. He didn't say any of that stuff. He said, here's what you need to fight the battle. He said, you need to put on truth, meaning be sincere, be genuine in who you are. Don't be deceptive. Don't be duplicitous. Don't give them a reason to discredit you because you're not who you present yourself to be. Put on truth is who you put forward to everyone else, who you really are. Paul says this will help you stand firm, is if you are who you are all the time and you are true. You are open, you are honest, you are genuine. You're not deceitful. Because if that's not who you really are, Satan will tear you apart. You've got a weakness that he will expose, and he will pull you away from the gospel. Paul said you need to be righteous. Put on truth, but you also need to be righteous, meaning you've committed your life to pursuing and reflecting the moral character of God. I've committed myself to pursuing and reflecting the moral character of God with my life. And the question is then, are you living the kind of life that will enable you to successfully engage in this conflict? Are you living the kind of life that will enable you to successfully engage in the conflict that you are a part of? Are you living a righteous life? If not, Satan will have any number of weaknesses to exploit. Put on righteousness. Put on truth. Paul said in order to stand firm, you must also be prepared by allowing the gospel to root your soul in peace. Be rooted in peace. There is inside us an inner turmoil that comes from the sin nature that causes in you doubt. It causes in you hopelessness. It causes you to question yourself. It causes you to question your hope, your salvation. It causes you to question these things. But the gospel brings us, it brings us confidence that God is in control. Are you prepared to fight? Are you confident? Have you allowed the fact that Jesus dealt with the biggest issue in your life? Are you allowed that fact to give you the confidence that if He can deal with your sin, if Jesus can deal with your sin and your eternal destiny, then Jesus can heal any immediate issues that you have? Root yourself in peace. When faced with the huge storms in the waters of Galilee, the disciples learned that if Jesus is in the boat, nothing is out of control. Has the gospel brought you peace that with God you can handle anything in life? If not, if you are not rooted in that peace, that if He can handle sin in eternity, He can handle anything else that comes. If you're not rooted in that peace, then Satan will push you until you fold. Paul says we have to put on truth. We have to put on righteousness. We have to be rooted in peace. He says, prepare yourself every day with that peace. And then he says, defend yourself with faith. Develop strong faith. Defend yourself with strong faith. Do you believe, and this is a genuine question, do you believe in the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, who was faithful to them, who promised to them, who came through to them and their children and their children's children? That God, do you believe in Him? Do you believe in the Creator God who made something out of nothing, who made everything out of nothing? Do you believe that Jesus was God, the Son, born, right? And His death defeated sin. His death defeated Satan, and the outcome has been decided. Do you believe that? Declare that faith. Build that trust in the Almighty God. I believe You're the Creator. I believe You've been faithful for generations. I believe You were that boy. I believe You defeated Satan and sin and death. And declare that faith and build that trust. Jesus told Jairus, whose daughter had died, fear not, only believe. How genuine is your faith? How convicted is your faith? How confident is your faith? If your faith in God is weak, you are vulnerable to Satan's. He says, defend yourself with a strong faith. Be convicted in what you believe about God. And then he says, in order to stand firm, you must hope in salvation. Do you have 1 foot out the door? Do you have 1 foot out the door here in this world? How hopeful are you for an eternal life on the new earth in the way that God intended us to live in the beginning? If your attachment is to this world and this life, and you have no hope of a coming salvation to a better life and a better world, then Satan can easily trap you with what this world offers. He can get you. And you'll be so focused on what this world offers, you won't be sharing the gospel, you won't be a part of the conflict, and you will be out. You have to put on a hope in salvation that the next life is millions of times better than this one, than what we're offered now. And then Paul says, if you're going to stand firm in this battle for the rescue of men, you must rely on and use God's words as they were intended. Depend on, rely on, use God's words contained in the Bible. They can challenge us. They can change us. They can transform us. They can defeat any lies and manipulations that Satan might make. It tells us truth. How practiced are you with God's words? How often do you wield and sharpen your understanding of His words? You must use God's words every day. Otherwise, Satan can easily slip under your guard. And so he says, we have to put on truth. Be genuine. Be real in who you are. Be righteous. Be rooted in peace. That if he can deal with your sin in eternity, he can deal with anything. Develop strong faith. Hope in salvation. Have 1 foot out the door. Use God's words every day so you know and you understand. Put these things on because your day of evil will come. And finally, though he doesn't understand it, I mean, assign it a piece of armor, Paul also says you must pray in verse 18. And pray in the Spirit on all occasions with all kinds of prayers and requests. With this in mind, be alert and always keep on praying for all the Lord's people. He doesn't give it a piece of armor, but it's part of the strategy. He says you must pray. Pray often. Pray always. Pray in every situation. Keep an open line of communication with God. And keep in mind, you are not the only warrior in this battle. You are not the only one that Satan is trying to keep from the conflict. Look up and down the battle lines and see that just like you, you have brothers and sisters standing shoulder to shoulder with you in the conflict, in the battle, trying to stand firm because their evil day is coming. Look up and down the battle lines at your brothers and sisters and stay alert to who is fighting and pray for them. Keep a focus on them and know that the others who are watching are praying for you too. Pray for each other. Pray always, because we are all the ones fighting the conflict now for the rescue and the souls of mankind. So how often do you pray? Pray for truth. Pray for righteousness. Pray for peace. Pray for more faith. Pray for hope. Pray for understanding of God's words. Pray that for your brothers and sisters, that they would be true, that they would be righteous, that they would be rooted in peace, that they would develop stronger faith and confidence, that they would hope in their salvation, that they would understand and use God's words effectively. And then Paul says, and here's where we'll finish, pray for one more thing. And this is personal for Paul, and I love where he takes this in verse 19. Paul says, and you pray also for me, that whenever I speak, words may be given me so that I will fearlessly make known the mystery of the gospel for which I'm ambassador in chains. Pray that I may declare it fearlessly as I should. So after describing this battle and how you can fight that battle, and gives us this image of warriors in the line of battle, watching and preparing and helping each other, after describing this warfare taking place and all the necessary things to stand firm and fight, Paul says, I'm going to take the battle to Satan. I'm going to go share the gospel. I'm going to go out and pursue the conflict. So pray for me. I want to be fearless. I'm going to go fight. And I think this is an example we should follow. Paul doesn't say, put on this part, but I think it's an example that we should follow, that we are prepared, we've stood firm, we are ready in the battle lines, and we should follow his example and be fearless and take the fight to Satan and share the gospel. Be fearless and share the gospel. This is part of the strategy to fight in the conflict that you are a part of. You are a part of the conflict, whether you want to be or not. If you're a believer or an unbeliever, you are part of the conflict. And if you're a believer, he may have been keeping you out of the conflict. But maybe now, seeing that what we celebrated 2 days ago, Jesus started and we were left to finish, we start putting on what Paul says is a strategy, and then we say, look to our right and our left and say, I'm going. Pray for me, because I'm going. Be fearless and share the gospel. Put on the armor of God, yes. Prepare for the days and moments of battle, but don't forget that Jesus came to rescue men from darkness. We just celebrated the beginning of that. And Satan tried to do everything he could to prevent the rescue from happening. And though Jesus is now in heaven waiting, Satan is still scheming and fighting. And our struggle as Christians is with him over the rescue of those around us. Satan doesn't care if you are poor. Satan doesn't care if you have great relationship with the people around you. He doesn't care about any of that stuff. All he cares is that you stop spreading the gospel. If that means you're poor, great. If it means you're rich, great. If it means you have fantastic relationships, great. If it means you have terrible relationships, great. He doesn't care at all about any of that stuff. He wants you to stop sharing the gospel. And that's what he's going to do. That's his strategy. The biggest threat to his plan in this conflict is that message, the message of rescue contained in God's words. And so, yes, we must stand firm in our evil day, in our day of struggle. But like Paul, we must fight. We must speak. Speak the gospel and take the battle to Satan. Check your armor and fearlessly do the thing that Satan has been trying to keep you from doing for so long. Presenting the gospel and seeing the salvation of a soul. For some of us, Satan has been successfully keeping us out of the conflict. We just celebrated the beginning of the rescue. Don't let that celebration end 2 days ago, and realize you are part of it now. And so maybe we've been kept out of the fight for years, but not this year. Not this year. I'm not one for resolution, but I suggest for 2021, we resolve the fight. Because he's fighting. Look at the cult. Look at your life. Look how we're down for the count. Stand up. Brush yourselves off. Put on the armor and fight. Let's pray.